KUAC FM in Fairbanks. Fans of A Prairie Home Companion can look forward to not only tonight's program, but on Speakers Forum at 12 today, the host of Prairie Home Companion, Garrison Keillor, will be the guest at the Press Club Banquet. So you can look forward to hearing Garrison Keillor not only this evening, but this afternoon at 12 o'clock. And coming up in just a few moments on Home Fires Radio Show, guest Alan Witcher talks to former members of the Peace Corps. So stay tuned for that. And of course, at 1 o'clock, the Chicago Lyric Opera will present La Traviata by Verdi, a whole slew of interesting programs to look forward to. Right now, I'll turn you over to Carla Tanella and Home Fires Radio Show.
Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm Ellen Witcher, substituting for Patty Kostelic, who's out of town this weekend. Our four guests today are going to be talking about the Peace Corps. They're all former volunteers. We have Sheila and Don Goddard, who were in Colombia, South America, and Guy Sadley, who served in India, and Tony Gasparo, who was in Dominican Republic. I discovered that was in the West Indies. I thought it was in Central America. Anyway, the Peace Corps is 25 years old this year, and you may have read about the big birthday party in March at the Kennedy Library in Boston, but there's going to be another birthday party right here next Saturday night when the Peace Corps volunteers, or the former Peace Corps volunteers in the Fairbanks area, are getting together for a potluck supper. And by the way, if you are one of those former volunteers and you haven't yet contacted anybody about the supper, at the close of the show at 12 o'clock, you can call the station, 474-7491, and tell any of these four people that you're coming. Or if you're listening and aren't even on the calling list, please call in and tell us, because they're eager to contact everybody in the area. The call-in number is 474-5044. Well, you don't want to hear me talk about it anymore. So I'm going to ask Dean Goddard to tell us a bit about, or a lot about, how the Peace Corps got started. I know it's had its ups and downs in the past 25 years, and I understand it's on the up again.
Well, Alan, the Peace Corps was originally an idea of John F. Kennedy that was first made public in a campaign address when he was campaigning for the presidency at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And he talked about the youth of America going to other countries of the world to help out. After he was elected, he did one of those Kennedy kinds of things and appointed his brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, to head up the Peace Corps and to bring it into existence. Here we are 25 years later talking about it.
I read somewhere that the idea that Hubert Humphrey had the idea to start with, but it was Kennedy that got it going. Is that so?
I believe you're right. I think it was originally
some sort of a Peace Corps. Uh-huh.
Originally a Humphrey idea, and Kennedy picked up on it, and you heard it in the inaugural address, "Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country," uh-huh. And the Peace Corps was part of that.
Uh-huh. And what were the goals then, same as they are now, I guess.
Hmm? Sometimes it's very difficult to put that into words. My experience as a volunteer in Colombia in 65 to 68 was that we were trying to do whatever we could to help the host country that we had been assigned to.
To have a better way of life, or what you considered a better way of life, or to improve their living conditions.
The project that we actually worked in was educational television, and so we were working in the schools, working uh-huh. with teachers, uh-huh. trying to change educational methods, improve education in Colombia. But in Latin America, there were a lot of volunteers who were assigned to what was called community development. And essentially, at its best, a volunteer was sent into a community with some specific projects in mind, to try to help that community do accomplish things that it wanted to accomplish. At its worst, a volunteer was parachuted into a community and had to figure out what was the volunteer there to do and what was the purpose of being there and how to do it and how to get the community to support it and to carry on with it. And in a number of instances, things were done. Volunteers returned years later and found that they were just, they had decayed and weren't used. Mm-hmm. In other instances, we were very lucky. We went back 7 years after we left Columbia and found things that we had only dreamed that might be possible had been accomplished.
Oh, wonderful. Well Sheila, tell me now, how did, I understand you met Dean in the Peace Corps, so how did you happen to volunteer? And where were you from?
Okay, where did it start? Actually, I guess the desire to go into the Peace Corps started the summer or the year before I actually applied for the Peace Corps. I was involved in what was called, and I don't know if it's still around, the Lyle Fellowship, which was in California. And there were people, there were 15 of us from different parts of the world, and we volunteered work in a number of projects in community development, fair housing campaign, camp for blind children, and we all worked together, and in a sense we were getting into other cultures in a very small way. I was a Kennedy follower, and after a year of teaching third grade, decided I wanted to go into the Peace Corps. I ended up in a training program for educational television. That project was to go to Columbia, South America. We trained at Cal State in California. I met Dean during training. That was in February of 1965. It was a very interesting project. There were essentially three different groups of people, producers, directors, TV technicians, and teachers, who were really more aptly generalist than anything else. There were 74 of us who trained together. I think we ended up with 54 actually going into country. We had intense training. We criticized our training, felt it was not enough to prepare us.
How long did you train?
For 3 months. Oh, three 2 months months at Cal State, and then 1 month in Puerto Rico. The reason we went to Puerto Rico was because Puerto Rico did have a national educational television network, and so we worked there with the people. We went, after the 3 months of training, we went into country, and
Sat for a month in Medellin.
That's right. We sat for a month where we became very disenchanted and asked ourselves, are we really here for, are we going to end up doing what we want to do and what we were supposed to do? After that 1 month of disorganization and deciding what was going to happen, where people were going to go, I ended up going to a community about a five-hour bus ride from the main city of Medellin, finally found housing through the help of the priest in the community.
How large a community?
Oh, I would say probably with the rural areas as well, maybe 40,000. Oh. It was on the side of a hill. It was called the town of the Los Tres Efes, Falduda, Feo, and Frio. And the translation for that is hilly, ugly, and cold. It was hilly. It was cold. It was not ugly. Dean and I disagree about that a bit, but it was...
You were both sent to the same...
No, hill? Actually not. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. We, at that time, were not married. We were good friends. I moved to Yarumal. I ended up living with a Colombian family for about a year before we decided to get married. And then I moved to the site where Dean was working. And the reason we did that was because there was more of an opportunity to work in larger number of schools. Mm-hmm. As Dean mentioned, the project that we were working in was educational television. And it was our goal to change the teaching methods of these teachers.
Did you speak Spanish? I mean, you must have had some.
I did not
facility in Spanish before you. No.
Well, before I went into training, no, I did not. Uh-huh. The training was quite good. I understand that it has improved somewhat since the time I was in training. It was enough to get me by, but I really learned my Spanish living with the family. I was the only American in town. They had not had an American there before, anyone who spoke English, and so I had lots of practice. In fact, I remember, especially the first few months, just going to bed at night with such a headache because it was just a lot coming at me, and I think people who are in another culture who are speaking an entirely different language experience the same thing.
You know you've been successful at it when you have your first dream in Spanish.
Oh, is that? And so, but you had no Spanish either when you went?
I'd had 2 years in high school and 2 years in college.
Un poquito.
Yeah, and had really wanted to go to Africa. And I think the reason I wound up in Latin America was because I managed to not psych out the process enough and had put down that I did Spanish and wound up in Latin America rather than Africa.
That was a question I had. Did you have any choice of where you were going?
Yes, they had a list of countries, and you could put down first, second, third choice.
And then
choice.
You might get your choice,
right.
And then again.
Right.
I know when I was in Red Cross, we were asked, but it didn't make any difference. You could answer, but they sent you where they wanted you.
Mm-hmm.
But you did. Was Colombia your first, second, or third?
Actually, my first choice was Africa. And because of some family difficulties, I ended up staying. I was invited to train for the African program, but did not go into that program because I had to help out my family. And so the next year, I was invited to go to the Colombia program. And that was fine with me.
Yeah. And look what happened.
Right.
And you were both there 2 years then?
Actually, mm-hmm. 3 years. We decided.
You extended?
We extended. And I think Dean and I both felt that after 2 years, we really knew what was going on. We felt comfortable in the culture. We really knew what our job was, and we knew the language. And at that time, when we felt we were at our most effective point, it was time to go home. And so we extended for another year. And the third year, mm-hmm. I believe, was the best year, was the year in which I was most effective. And, of course, as I think we may get to talk about this, that it's very difficult going back.
How about you, Guy? You went to India. Oh, you told me. Now, what did you tell me?
Bill
Moyers was the one that got
yes.
you all fired up. And, you go ahead and tell us. This is Guy Sattley.
I wanted to jump into Dean and Sheila's conversation a couple of times. Yes, I was first recruited, I guess, by Bill Moyers back in the spring of 61, although I didn't join until 1966. Moyers was on the team, Shriver's team, in the original Peace Corps, and he came around doing one-night stands at Midwest universities, and I was at the University of Illinois for a year, and so Moyers was my first contact with Peace Corps. It's a small world for listeners of public radio and public television, I must say.
Right.
Eventually, I kept on in school and did a lot of traveling, and eventually joined in 1966, trained at the University of Kentucky. And I was thinking about this last night, and I was reminded of John Glenn's comment, flying into space, that he was flying on a rocket that was built by the low bidder. certainly everything we're going to say this hour is not going to be totally positive about the Peace Corps experience. We all hope it's gotten a lot better. University of Kentucky was the low bidder on our training program.
Why are you training for India at the University of Kentucky?
Well, after 3 months, 4 months of training, a lot of us were asking the same question.
Oh.
And I'm not being frivolous. There really were a lot of problems with the India training. Indira Gandhi had come to the States in 66, and apparently we had asked her what she wanted in India, and so the story went in Peace Corps circles. She said she wanted twice as many Peace Corps volunteers. There were about 500 or 550 in India at the time, which is a mammoth amount mm-hmm. by itself. Peace Corps India doubled its number of volunteers in 4 or 6 months. And, of course, you have volunteers leaving all the time after 2 or 3 years, and so you're not only replacing those, but you're basically doubling the base number. They didn't do anything to the staff in India. So when we got to India in January of 67, the staff was totally run ragged going
they
to the
same air. Number of staff. They didn't
same number of staff.
Staff.
Didn't do anything to the staff, the support staff. We had, there were 6 or 8 sub-offices in India, each with doctors, nurses, drivers, secretaries, and so on. Did nothing to the staff, doubled the number of volunteers, so that by the time that we got there in 67, there were 1,100 volunteers in country. And we really got very little staff support over 2 years. But that sounds very negative. We trained at the University of Kentucky for 2.5 months and then went to India for in-country training for another month and a half. And language training in India was much better than language training in Kentucky.
I think the Peace Corps learned from that.
I think so.
I don't think they're training at all in the U.S. now.
We did critiques of our training. Until we were firmly in the village in South India, we were a little tentative about doing critiques because we might not move on any further. But once we were in South India, we were very, very critical of our training, and I think they did learn. Basically, now they just have a week or 10 days in the U.S. and then ship the
Go
trainees
right
to the country. And there's, of course, an increased, if you assume that 10 or 20% or 30% of your trainees will basically be, they used the word deselected back there in the 60s.
Yes.
If you assume that a certain number will be deselected at the end
of
training.
You mean kicked out?
Kicked out, but
right.
Deselected.
Deselected,
is a
I see.
Bureaucratic word. You have an increased cost for transportation to ship those people back to the States that you wouldn't have if you were training in the States, but the training is so much better, especially for language. Our language training started over when we got to South India.
And also now, aren't they more selective, the people they take? I mean, they have to have some skills. They don't just take some
I hope so, but
liberal arts graduate who doesn't know what else
well,
to
in our case, I remember we went there to teach village-level agriculture, hybrid seeds, fertilizer, irrigation, land leveling.
Was that your background?
No.
I mean,
this ties
you
into what you
knew nothing about it?
No, absolutely nothing.
I see.
And we were what they called BA generalists, or the acronym was BAGS, B-A-G-S.
Kennedy's.
Yes, the theory being that if you're literate and book-oriented and so on, you can absorb lectures for 3 or 4 months and then go out to the village and spiel out this information in the local language. To a certain extent, it's true, but there are some flaws to the logic.
In our project, the counterpart to that was you knew enough about the educational system to be able to work with teachers in Colombia simply because you had been through the U.S. educational system. Not necessarily. And Sheila had been trained as a teacher. I had not been trained as a teacher. I was one of those BA generalists that Guy was talking about, and there was a certain amount of, I think, cultural imperialism from the standpoint of the U.S. system is better, and we can teach the Colombians how to do it the better way simply by taking BA generalists who've been through 16 years of education or more in the United States, and they've absorbed the way our educational system works, and they can go out and teach it to somebody else.
I'll just throw in one more thing before you move on to Tony. By the time we got to the village, there were 28 of us in 28 separate villages in South India, all male, no females. I didn't see a female Peace Corps volunteer for a year. I kept reading wonderful color brochures from Washington about nurses and teachers. We were all male and in separate villages, and it was quite a contrast of life to what the Goddards have, and that's fine. I think it's good that we have a contrast here of geographical areas and so on. But of 28 of us in 28 villages, there were 2 of us who had any previous experience of agriculture. One fellow grew up on a farm, one fellow had been to ag school for a couple of years. 26 of us were generalists who were basically told in 4 months of training, this is the gospel according to hybrid crops and fertilizer and irrigation. Now go out and spread the word. And if that sounds too negative, I'm sorry. But that's basically the way it was. And Peace Corps was desperately trying to get agriculturally oriented people to sign up for the Peace Corps, but unfortunately, they, for some reason, and probably is still the case, you couldn't motivate them. You couldn't get them to sign up for the Peace Corps.
Well, and it was partly the time, and this was
That's
Vietnam,
right, and we can get into that. We've got a lot of time here. Mm-hmm. We are all ex-volunteers from the 1960s, and the 1960s is not the 1980s. There was a lot happening in the 1960s, and it had a lot to do with the motivations and the dedication you had when you
so
got there.
So it was at its height, say, in 63 or so, in the early, or 65,
I went in 66, and I was there until 68. Dean and Sheila were there 65 to 68, and I guess Tony was before
when were you
any
there,
of us.
Tony?
I was in the Dominican Republic from 62 to early 65.
So you were in the beginning, too. Uh-huh. Well, so then things kind of went down. Now I understand they're coming up again. I better, maybe somebody's just dying to call us. Our number is 474-5044. So if you would like to add to this conversation or ask questions, please do call us. We're just waiting for that little light to blink.
I think it would be interesting to receive calls from volunteers who have recently returned, volunteers from the early or mid-80s. I think it would be very interesting to hear their opinions.
Mm-hmm. Tony, tell us, how did you happen to go to the West Indies?
Well, first of all, I applied for a very technical group. It was a forestry group, and the requirements to be in the group was a degree in forestry or some of the natural sciences. So most of our group were technically trained. And I say that guardedly because we may have been technically trained, but most of us had very little experience. And when you get on the ground in the third world country, it's important to have that experience. So we were quite green when we embarked on our project. My project started on a rather ominous note. It was delayed 3 months by the Cuban Missile Crisis. Those of you who know where the Dominican Republic is, it's quite close to Cuba. So we didn't start until November, training until November of 1962, when we were trained at the University of Washington in Seattle. Why the University of Washington? I imagine it's because they probably thought that we were going to be working in a tropical, rainy rainforest, but much to, I think, their surprise and ours, too, most of the forests that we ended working in were dry pine forests in the high reaches of the Cordillera Central of the Dominican Republic. We trained for 2.5 or 3 months in Seattle, and then, like Sheila, went to Puerto Rico. And there our training was divided between an outdoor survival training for 2 weeks, and then I spent 2 weeks at the Luquillo National Forest Experiment Station. Do we have a call coming in? Or?
Yes, we do.
Okay, why don't I break for that?
Yes.
We'd love to hear a call.
You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I just got back from Paraguay a couple months ago,
and my
sister was in the Peace Corps there, is still in the Peace Corps, and I was just going to reiterate kind of what you were saying about training. I don't think it's really changed very much. Her training was just, she had worked a little bit with bees and then took a couple agriculture economics classes, and that basically was it, and they just pretty much turned her loose. I think that it hasn't changed very much from the sounds of it.
I understand that there are only two countries in South America that ask for volunteers, Paraguay and Ecuador. Where was she from? I mean, where was she recruited from?
Pardon? I can't hear you.
I said, where was your sister recruited?
She was recruited from California. Oh, she went to UC Davis.
I see.
And she's living in a small town near Brazil.
And you went down to visit her?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting. How much longer will she be there? Is she going to extend for 3 years?
No, I don't think so. She'll be there till January. She's been there a year and a half now. And they've had some really hot summers, and she's actually leaving 3 months earlier than she'd planned to because of the hot summers.
And now what did you say her project is that she's working
it's
on?
In,
or she had to find one?
Yeah, it's in beekeeping.
Beekeeping.
Uh-huh.
Well, you said she'd had a little training in bees. That would help somewhat.
Yeah, right. But just talking to the other people that I met, I was there for a month and a half or so, and most of them hadn't really, you know, had, some of them had had training, but a lot of them hadn't.
Maybe they're learning more than they're teaching.
Well, that's what she had told me, that the three goals of the Peace Corps now, maybe they were the same in the beginning, I don't know, but one was to try to teach the people something so that they could, you know, have some skills after you left, and also to learn about the people, learn about their culture, and also the third thing was to teach them about your culture.
Yes, and then and come back here also and tell what you learned there.
Uh-huh. Right.
Could I ask a question? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Is the project that your sister is in, is it a project that will continue after she leaves, or will there be another volunteer to fill her slot, or will it sort of perhaps die on the vine because she's keeping it going?
Yeah, it's hard to say. They just started with beekeeping about 2 years ago because they've had this, the killer bee, as they call it, the right. Africanized bee there. So they've just started up working with these bees, and they probably will not have anyone to replace her in the small town where she is at.
That's interesting because it ties into what Sheila had to say earlier and some of my experience in South India. Peace Corps India's experience was that although it might make sense on paper to follow up a project with another volunteer, in other words, to put another volunteer into my village after I left after 2 years, it was outweighed by the bad experiences they had had with the new volunteer coming in, not having the language facility, constantly being compared with the outgoing volunteer as far as knowing who was who, as far as knowing the political system, knowing the technical information, and especially the language ability in our situation. And so they had basically given up in India replacing volunteers with another one in the same slot. And I was just curious whether they had figured that problem out in 20 years.
Yeah, I know in a lot of places they do replace, you know, someone, but I think in this village they may not. I'm not sure, though.
Okay. Really interesting to hear from you.
Yeah,
thank you for calling.
Our situation is a little bit different. Ours was a very well-defined project from the beginning. The reason that you could do educational television in Colombia was that there's a national curriculum. At every sixth grade classroom at 10:45 on a Monday morning, you knew what was going on in everyone across the country. And so you could put on a program in social studies at that time and know that it would work because the curriculum was the same. And so we started out with 1,500 television sets that AID had donated to the project, a national television network that an earlier dictator had built in Colombia, a school system that had a national curriculum. And so it was ready-made for a well-defined project that right from the very beginning had the idea in mind that it was going to work itself out of a job. So we started out with Colombian television teachers, producer-director types in the studios in Bogota who were training Colombians, and eventually by the time we left, there were no producer-directors, Peace Corps producer-directors left in the studio. Mm-hmm. The project was entirely Colombian-run out of Bogota. Technicians out in the field who were training Colombians how to repair the sets so that Colombians would eventually repair the sets and no Peace Corps volunteer would have to go back and do that. And then what we called utilization volunteers, those of us who were in the classroom, working with teachers. By the time we went back 7 years after we had left Colombia, they were doing things that we had only dreamed about. While I was there, I worked with my Colombian counterpart trying to get them to order spare parts for the sets that had broken down that they couldn't replace. His solution was, well, we'll just go to Venezuela and smuggle them across the border. That was the way he was going to, and I didn't think the Peace Corps would be too happy about that. So we wrote and got no response. 7 years later, they were not only buying replacement parts, they had bought replacement sets and were expanding far beyond our imagination. They were taking sets into villages where there was no electricity, where they had to run by generator. Had to run the TV set by a generator. So we worked ourselves out of a job and found that it worked successfully.
So it varies from country to country.
Certainly.
I know
the experiences varied from volunteer to volunteer.
Sure.
The projects varied from volunteer to volunteer. The value varied from country to country.
You were operating in Spanish or in English?
Spanish. If you didn't speak Spanish,
well,
you didn't eat.
I appreciated that with the students, but I thought perhaps the professionals you were working with in English. That's another difference, too, as far as replacing the volunteers, because certainly there were, I assume, a lot of volunteers available who had some fluency in Spanish or who were easily trainable. And in our situation in South India, there are something like 14 major languages in India, along with several hundred minor ones, and the one we spoke in Mysore state, which is now called Karnataka, it was Kannada, Kannarese language, a Dravidian language, and basically they found no practical way to teach it to us in the U.S., certainly not at the University of Kentucky, and so in that case a volunteer coming into the same slot and filling the same slot would basically be starting with very little language ability, and would be in a village setting, not a professional setting, but in a village setting, would be at a significant disadvantage.
Yeah, Tony, back to your pine forest. Were you speaking Spanish there?
Well, yeah, like Dean's project, ours was quite well defined. We had a forestry mission in the country. The country was being overlogged. There was a severe erosion problem. There were small farmers that were, in order to eke a living out in the mountains, were setting fires. And these fires were spreading into the valuable forest areas. As a result, there was severe erosion. The World Bank wouldn't lend the country any money because the dams would fill up with silt. So our job was pretty clear cut to develop to work with counterparts and develop a forest management program. Mm-hmm. Unlike the other three colleagues here, our country was politically very, very unstable. Shortly after we arrived there, probably 6 or 7 months into our service there, there was a bloodless coup. We were all confined to our villages, our communities, by machine gun toting army jeeps and guards wandering the streets. There were curfews. We could not wander into the mountains and do our job because for fear of contacting guerrillas. And so, as a result, we just switched projects, and I began to teach English as a second language lasted about 4 or 5 months. It was very frustrating to us, and we saw all of our work sort of going down the drain. But after that, things stabilized a bit. We were able to establish a forest guard school, and we trained 60 Dominican personnel in basic forest ranger skills, and we were very, very satisfied with that turn of events. I did leave the country before the U.S. invasion, which I believe occurred in 1965. So I missed the worst part of this political instability. But as a whole, I would say while I was there, my experience was a very positive one. However, again, like Sheila and Dean, I did return after 8 or 9 years from the country as a UN representative. And much to my sadness, things had gotten worse. Our forest guards, because of the politics of that country, had all been replaced by people who didn't know how to do their job. And the mountains looked a lot worse. The forestry situation had deteriorated significantly, and I understand that's occurring right now. So things, as far as Dominican Republic forestry is concerned, didn't have too much of a happy ending.
We have another phone call. You generate phone calls, Tony.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but thank you for waiting. You're on the air now, though.
I was a volunteer in Cameroon, West Africa, from 74 to 77 in inland fisheries and wildlife. And I agree with a lot of things that were said, but I think the individual nature of each country and project and training program is really pretty important. And I had a really excellent training program and real excellent preparation. Language is always a bit of a problem because I think no matter what kind of classroom training you get in language, until you're really forced to use it on a daily basis for an extended time, you're not going to pick it up and get fluent, so there's always that sort of troublesome period. And I think that from the standpoint of long-term effects of what you do, I agree that a lot of times, going back at some point in the future and trying to look back on what actually has been accomplished can be a little bit frustrating, but I think that I feel real positive about the experience in a lot of different ways. And I think mostly on the basis of the individual contacts and the cross-cultural sort of things that went on and the what I was able to convey. But I think that when I was in the Peace Corps, there was a real struggle in the Peace Corps administration over whether Peace Corps should start supplying more and more technical specialists for specific type of projects, or go back to the old thing about, you know, the general liberal arts type person just providing the contact with the U.S. And the tendency in the Peace Corps in the mid to late 70s was for countries to start requesting more and more specialized professions, such as wildlife biology or hydrology or different sorts of things like that, which within the State Department, they were thinking that this maybe was more something that should be done by USAID or something like that, and less the Peace Corps. And every time there was a change in the upper administration of the Peace Corps and the politics of the situation, there was a change in the emphasis. But I think that some of the little more specialized people with training can do quite a bit in some of these areas, even just on a short-term basis.
Could I ask you a question? These requests for specialized people were, in your experience, and it would depend on how close you were to the probably to the capital of the country and to the main Peace Corps office and the administrators, but in your experience, were those requests genuinely generated by the government of the Cameroons, or were they to some extent perhaps fed to them by the American embassy, who said, hey, we've got 20 hydrologists sitting in Wyoming and we'd love to send them to you, why don't you request them? That you may suspect that sort of thing happened in India. Can you say whether either way?
In my experience, a lot of the requests were from Cameroon. And I think even some of the there was a detrimental side to that, because like in some of the inland fisheries programs, they got some real good programs going with people raising fish in fish ponds and getting some real positive things going. Had some trained African counterparts who were capable of taking over the program, but a lot of times a local African official within a particular area liked the idea of having a Peace Corps volunteer there.
Raised status and so on.
To help. And so he would continue to request an additional volunteer in some of the programs that were beginning to take off with local African support.
Right.
And I think a lot of the stuff I'm familiar with, it was requests that came pretty much. I don't think Peace Corps really was pushing some of these other programs. And the other thing is Cameroon was to the point where there were enough Africans who had been trained in the States or in Europe and were aware of the possibilities of a lot of these different fields and recognized the lack of any expertise within their country, you know, to begin to request them. I don't think anybody, you know, there were enough people in the Cameroonian government who were, you know, really interested in getting some of these other types in there.
Right. Okay. It's good to get a perspective from the 1970s. Thanks much.
Also, I think it was you bring up something that we've tended to ignore. We've focused greatly on the what you might call the more professional aspects of the Peace Corps, the jobs that we were doing in the country, and we've not focused nearly enough on the personal relationships that volunteers built up, on the knowledge that volunteers bring back to the United States. As from cross-cultural living. Thank you for bringing that up.
Would you like to give us your name so we can make sure that you're on the list here?
Well, I'm pretty sure I'm probably not on your list.
And you don't want
I just heard about, you know, I just kind of casually heard this on the radio, but my name is John Hechtel.
John Hechtel.
Right, you're not on the list.
And they want you on their list.
Not only that, we'd like to invite you and any other returned volunteers who are listening to the program right now to join us. It's a potluck next Saturday, May 31st at 6:30 in the evening at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church, which is at 1030 2nd Avenue downtown. And welcome to bring either some food from the cuisine of the Cameroons or American food if you can't get the ingredients or would prefer to bring American food. We're going to sit around and just have any returned volunteers who we've made contact with in Fairbanks, and Tony has put together a list of, what, about 45?
Yeah, I might add, just by word of mouth, we have compiled a list of about 45 return volunteers representing 21 different countries right in the Fairbanks area, and most of us are sure that there are even more than this. So, again, I encourage anyone out there that is a returned volunteer to contact us, particularly if you would want to call right after the program.
The number right after the program would be 474-7491. But if you call us during the program, it's 474-5044. And thank you very much, John Hechtel.
Thank you.
You know, Alan, one thing when I was thinking about coming on the program, one experience that I thought said a lot about Peace Corps and volunteers that I wanted to repeat was a time I was sitting in a cantina in Rio Negro. And
is that in Colombia?
Yeah, that's in Colombia and out in the dropping middle of the Andes.
It's translated Black River.
Oh, yeah, I figured that out.
A bunch of us had just sat around town, and they'd wound up the whole table full of beer bottles late at night. And one guy and I were remaining at the table, and I had seen him around town. He worked in a hardware store. Never had really had much contact with him, but we'd obviously both had a lot of beer. And by midnight, with the two of us left at the table, he sidled up to me and said that he wanted me to know that he was the local leader of the Communist Party, and that come the revolution, that we should find him, and he would make sure that we would get out of Colombia safely.
That was nice, reassuring.
Well, it was interesting in that there was no personal animosity on his part towards us as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he had gone out of his way. I mean, I had never known him, and I'd seen him on the street. It was about as close as we'd gotten, but he'd gone out of his way to make clear that he was the local communist leader and that he would get us safely out when the revolution came. The revolution never came while we were there, nor since. But it spoke to me of the willingness of people to relate on a person-to-person kind of basis, where they might, stand up and loudly criticize the United States,
right,
and say, "Oh, you're a Peace Corps, you're different."
That's right. Certainly, speaking for myself, the best memories I have are the relationships with the villagers and the people in the local area. I remember thinking back to when I came back to the States in 69, 70, and so on. I think I've mellowed in the last 20 years or so, but I used to get very aggravated when people who would learn about the 2 years in the Peace Corps in India, their first question, and basically their only question, was, wasn't it fun? Didn't you have a good time? And I reacted at that time very negatively to that, and I would wave my arms and say, hey, it was technical assistance, and we were supposed to be pushing, seeds and crops and land leveling and fertilizer and irrigation and the whole shopping list of stuff. I think I've sort of backed off from that irritation at this point, but it's not a... I think we've made very clear in the last 45 minutes that it's certainly not a vacation. It's work. No matter what changes they've made in the last 20 years to the program,
it is more work.
It is technical assistance. Sometimes the technical assistance doesn't work as well as it should. Sometimes the training isn't as good as it should. We all thought, I think, that it was a positive step in a world of the 1960s, which had a lot of negative factors going on.
I think one thing we've talked about a lot here, it's kind of been a theme, and that is that there are positive and negative things to the training, the experience, both professional and personal, and also to the project. And Ellen, you mentioned something, and that is that I think we all gained something. We were able to certainly give, depending upon the project. There were degrees of being able to give, but I know myself, and I think in talking to Peace Corps volunteers, whether they had a positive, which was my experience, or a negative experience, you gain a whole lot more than I think you ever give. And I think it certainly was that way for me. I think I had 10 years of both personal and emotional growth in 3 years. Maybe it was more than 10 years. I don't know, but I was able to learn a great deal through personal relationships, people with whom I still keep in contact, an appreciation of two very drastically different cultures, a sense of community. I experienced a sense of community in Colombia that I had never experienced before and have not experienced again except living here in Fairbanks, and that's why I like it and appreciate it so much. And then also realizing that everyone does have an ability to affect change. Our regional director in Colombia mentioned to us, he said, you work, you may not see the fruits of your labor now, and even if you come back in 10 years, you may not, but you have to think of your work as a bird on the top of a very large mountain, a very small bird, and he's pecking away. And, you know, see yourself maybe in that, and that should give you optimism.
That's nice. I like that that vision, especially when I think back to a country of 500,000 villages and 500 million Indians back then, and now I think 700 million. You really feel like you're sticking your finger in the ocean and making a hole, and when you remove your finger, you haven't done much. But I like Sheila's allusion there.
I might mention, this is Tony Gasparo again, I might mention sort of a positive spin-off that occurred to me as a result of my Peace Corps experience. After returning to the country, I went back to the woods and worked with the U.S. Forest Service for 5 years. And frankly, I ended up in the Tongass National Forest in Southeast and in a rather isolated situation, and things got kind of bored, and I let my I let my boss know, and sure enough, a few days later, an application came across my desk for a position with the United Nations in Rome, Italy, with the Food and Agriculture Organization. And I applied, and it was because of my Peace Corps experience, one, that I had the language, and two, that I had cross-cultural experience, that I did get the job in Rome as a project operations officer, responsible for sometimes eight Latin American forestry projects funded by the United Nations Development Program. And I, as a result, I spent almost 3 years in Italy, traveling quite a bit. But I owe that job to my Peace Corps experience. And furthermore, now I've returned to Alaska. I've been here 15 years. I'm beginning to think again, and the urge is there to go abroad again.
The Peace Corps wants you.
Well, maybe not with the Peace Corps, yeah. but there's a vacuum. There's something missing in my life. I just feel that again. I feel something calling to go back again, and maybe try to contribute again. I'm not sure if and when it will occur, but it's there, and that's probably why we're all here today. There is something there. There is a need for all of us return volunteers to talk about and share our experiences, and we're not sure what's going to come become of our group, what's going to happen at this first get-together. But in talking to people on the phone who have been calling in, there's a lot of enthusiasm for this meeting, and people have talked about maybe forming a formal group of returned Peace Corps volunteers, but we'll see what happens at our get-together on May 31st.
Yeah, I might add on that, Ellen, there was a great deal of debate in the early years of the formation of the Peace Corps whether or not for the Peace Corps to organize organizations of returned volunteers. And Sergeant Schreiber always opposed it. As did many volunteers coming back, and that they just kind of looked over at the American Legion and saw all these people sitting around telling war stories.
Right. Right.
They didn't want a whole bunch of groups of people sitting around telling peace stories. I think some of us are going to tell some peace stories next Saturday, and maybe we will have a group come out of that.
And I think also that ties into, and it's just beginning to come back after 20 years, there was a concept, a very valid concept back then, of 5 years and out, as I recall. And I think Shriver basically signed on for it, I assume, for 5 years, and said, and basically the idea, and I think this came down from Kennedy, was that, although I imagine he would have settled for 8 years and out, that basically you put your best in a job for 4 or 5 years and then move over for somebody new to get on with the job and bring in some new perspectives and so on. And that's just coming back to me now, but that was a common, not just a slogan. I don't want to say slogan.
That reminds me when it may be 5 years, it may be 3 years. And
right.
We were in for 3 years,
right.
Which was at that time, I think, the most you could be in for Peace Corps. I'm not
sure.
Was
it
five?
They really didn't want to even let us have that third year. It
right.
was it was really tight to get an extension for an additional year.
But one thing that I remember when we were getting ready to leave, the new group of volunteers were coming in, and they were asking, you know, some of the same questions that we had asked when we were there. And I remember thinking some of the answers that we were giving them were similar to the answers that Colombians had given us. And that said to me, okay, Sheila, it's time to leave. Also, there were some other questions that people were asking which disturbed me, and things like, well, you know, can I have a refrigerator, and can I live in the city, and I didn't want to hear that.
A motorcycle. The people in India wanted a motorcycle instead of the bicycles that we had. Some of what Sheila says is really beginning to ring a bell for me now, certainly we were the most valuable at the end of our 2 years of service, and the volunteers, those volunteers out of the 28, I think there were four or five who extended for a third year, they were really productive. They knew the language, they knew the people and everything.
Well, in the Peace Corps today, there are 6,000 now, and they're aiming for 10,000 in the next 10 years. And I also read they're serving in 62 different countries. But there are more in Ecuador than any other place because Ecuador asks for them. They like them there, and they want them.
I wonder... go on.
You wonder what?
I was going to ask Tony. We have the virtue here of not having shared... stories here in the past, so we can. This is the first exposure. You were in forestry, and there was a Nova show a year or two ago on forestry in Nepal, how the erosion is really endangering the forests and the fuel source and everything in Nepal, washing away the hillsides. And I just wonder if you happen to know, and it's a totally out of the blue question, if any of the three of you have read anything about whether the Peace Corps Nepal is doing anything in erosion control or forestry management, anything like that. I know Peace Corps Nepal is a viable operation.
Mm-hmm. They're asking for computer scientists, among other things, in Nepal.
Yeah. I asked to go to Nepal first, I got South India. So
Oh, Tony, I didn't even let you answer.
Oh, well, that's fine. I don't have too much to say because I don't know about specific projects. But when I have heard talk about Peace Corps Nepal, I have heard talk about projects involving what we call agroforestry, where actually trees are introduced on cropland and crops are grown beneath the trees. And I'm sure that type of a project is taking place in Nepal, although I don't know anything about the specific details.
I'm sure we have a bunch of former Nepal volunteers in the Fairbanks area. I see only one, I believe, on Tony's list here. And
is that Stan Justice?
Yes, yeah. I believe so. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly a lot of people in the Fairbanks area who've traveled through Nepal and met a lot of volunteers out there, and it's a very successful program in Nepal.
Yeah. None of you had read that article in Smithsonian, so maybe I better tell the listeners, too. If you'd like to know more about the Peace Corps today, in the February Smithsonian magazine, there's quite a long article with those beautiful Smithsonian pictures called The Peace Corps Comes of Age. I think that's where I read that among the requests from Nepal was for computer scientists. And I had seen that Nova show, and so I was looking to see if they didn't want some soil specialists, but it wasn't mentioned there.
Well, the tendency has been on, as the caller mentioned earlier, to go more for technical than for the BA generalists. You know, it's had its ups and downs over the years, and the first groups were really BA generalists without very much
of the
specific...
Did you have to take any kind of an exam or anything before you went, or just sort of a general thing?
You had to fill out an application.
12-page application.
Oh, yeah.
Every place you had ever lived, ever worked. I don't think it's quite that bad now.
No, they did a security check, too.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah,
right.
very extensive.
They did the lowest level...
By the way, were you paid? Nowadays they get a little something, don't they?
$75 a month.
Yeah, I think now it's $225.
Yeah.
See,
inflation in 20 years.
And your expenses, but you had to find your own living quarters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, in the village in South India, they did find the living quarters. In my case, it was a 10x12 little stone and mud house with no windows and so on. To give you some perspective on the economics of the situation, we were paid 500 rupees, Indian rupees, a month for living expenses, and which only translates to $50 or $60, and yet that made us in the village grossly overpaid. We not only worked for a Peace Corps supervisor in the state capital 200 miles away, but we worked for a local man block development officer 7 miles away. And I think we made more money not only than him, but his boss and his boss.
But
there was no place to spend it, so, you know.
They, yes. But the supervisors, were they natives? I mean, India, or do you mean from Peace Corps?
Oh, yes. No. We had two bosses, and the Peace Corps boss was 200 miles away and came around once every 3 months in a Jeep for 1 hour. And if you detect some criticism there, that's fine. The local boss was Indian Block Development Officer, Mysore State Agriculture Department, and he was our local boss. The money was irrelevant because there was nothing in my village. There was one lady who sold cigarettes and matches. That's what was in the village, and you had to ride your bicycle 7 miles to do any shopping at all. So you could have had 1 million rupees a month. It wouldn't have made any difference.
I might just say a few things about pay. We were paid about what our counterparts were getting, and any time we brought that up, the Dominicans were quick to point out, you're getting the same amount, but look at all the backup you have. Mm-hmm. If there's a hepatitis epidemic,
that's right.
The Peace Corps doctor comes right out and gives you shots. Mm-hmm. We got books, and we got all sorts of supplies. We had a truck. So, again, as Guy said, we make an attempt. They've made an attempt to put us on the same level of our counterparts, but it never really turns out that way.
Now, our situation was similar to Tony's, and that is we were getting paid at the same level of the teachers with whom we worked. But yes, we did have the medical opportunities, and we had our Peace Corps medical kit and our book locker. And so
the book locker.
The book locker.
Yes.
You mean you got...
It was a cardboard box.
It was a wonderful box.
An assortment, you
couple
mean?
A couple hundred, paperback books.
Yeah.
Oh,
I even had a cookbook, Fanny Farmer cookbook, I remember.
Oh,
that was valuable.
Which you did.
Yes.
It was.
Well, sure.
It was dog-eared after 2 years of my cooking, I can assure you.
Well, would you all do it again if you had the opportunity? You wouldn't. Guy wouldn't. Well, he's thinking.
Oh, I would in the 1960s. I would, given the same circumstances.
But maybe you'd like it in the 80s now.
With the new
director. Oh, maybe somebody out there knows how to pronounce her name. The director. Rupp. R-U-P-P-E. Ella Lorette.
I understand
she's
what Tony said.
She's turned things around,
about thinking about it again. I've thought about it again. Mm-hmm. That's true. It comes back every so often.
Oh, we have a phone call.
A phone call.
Mm-hmm. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Do you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Micronesia from 77 to 79.
Oh. Wow.
And I was a teacher there. And what was really interesting, well, first of all, you've been talking a little bit here about pay. One little thing I wanted to say was that I was getting about as much money as all the other teachers there. But you see, through the extended family, their paycheck, I mean, just, it was like liquid. It just went right through the whole island.
Uh-huh.
It was an atoll. And my paycheck, I mean, I could just save and save until when the summer came. I could go on vacation and do whatever I wanted.
Uh-huh.
So it was a whole different concept. And then later on, as I got more comfortable the next year, then I started to feel more responsible.
Uh-huh.
And so then all of a sudden, my paycheck started to become more and more liquid. But it was just a whole different concept. Sometimes when you think about money, the parity of, you just can't make any, you can't make those kinds of assumptions because through extended family, if one person has a paycheck, you know, everybody prospers through that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing I saw that was a little bit different. But I don't know. The reason why I called was this. Something that really awoke in me as a Peace Corps volunteer was that the United States, I got a whole different attitude between what you see on the TV and the State Department here, and then all of a sudden when you go over there and see how the State Department and our foreign policy works. And it frightened me. All of a sudden, mm-hmm. you know, you're sort of fooled somewhat when you're here in the United States. You actually think that the State Department actually looks at these people as real. But when I was over there and I did some traveling, it was frightening. It's like they're not real. They're just sort of computer printouts or something. And I just wanted to say that and see if anybody else got that same kind of
opinion. We could have another program on that.
You're getting a lot of nods around the table.
You must come Saturday night and tell them. We just have about a half a minute left.
Oh,
thank
I'm
you
sorry.
For calling.
Okay.
I do want to remind people that is this coming Saturday night at 6:30 at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church. It is for returned Peace Corps volunteers. It is a potluck. If you would bring a dish that would serve about 4 to 6 people, we'd love to see you.
You've been listening to four former Peace Corps volunteers, Sheila and Dean Goddard, Guy Sadley, and Tony Gasparo. And I'm Ellen Whitcher, and next week, Patty Costello will be back.
Having a great time here at KUAC FM Fairbanks. That's some Indian music from Paraguay. And coming up in just a few moments on Speakers Forum is the Press Club with host Garrison Keillor. So you'll be able to hear him in just a few moments, as well as at 6 o'clock on A Prairie Home Companion. Also on Assorted Affairs today at 4:30, we have a program examining computer culture. It's the part one of this series. The first one's entitled Silicon Valley Fever. It's an examination of the rise of high technology culture with Everett Rogers of Stanford University and Judith Larson from Cognos Associates. So that's at 4:30 today on Assorted Affairs. And the opera today from the Lyric Opera of Chicago is La Traviata by Verdi. Stay tuned for an afternoon of interesting and enjoyable radio here on KUAC FM in Fairbanks.
Support for this program is provided by National Public Radio member stations and the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the General Foods Corporation providing food and beverage products around the world, Discover Magazine, a guide to an accelerating world, and Carnegie Corporation of New York. This program is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content.
From Washington, D.C., this is another in the continuing series of programs from the National Press Club. I'm Frank Stasio. Today's guest speaker is author and public radio celebrity, Garrison Keillor.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Lee Roderick. I'm Washington Bureau Chief for Scripps League Newspapers and Chairman of the Board of the Club. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are listening to this program over one of the 303 national public radio stations or watching on one of the 1900 cable systems affiliated with C-SPAN, the Cable Satellite Public Affairs Network. Before going any further, I'd like to remind our members of some coming events. Next Wednesday, May 28th, our guest will be past chairman of the Federal Reserve Board and former ambassador to West Germany, Dr. Arthur Burns. Speakers next month include John Kenneth Galbraith on June 9th, Argentina's foreign minister, Dante Caputo, on June 11th, Mayor Wilson Good of Philadelphia on June 12th, Senator Richard Lugar on June 17th, and Austrian Chancellor Dr. Fred Sinowitz on June 25th. I'd like to remind those of you in the audience that if you have any questions for our speaker, and I hope you will, please write them on the cards furnished at your tables, and we'll pass them up, and I'll ask as many as time allows. I'd like now to introduce the guests at our head table. I'd ask our guests to please stand briefly when their names are read, and ask you in the audience to please withhold your applause until I have read all the names. Starting at my left and your right, we have Dane Smith of Knight Ridder Newspapers, Bob Andrews of the Associated Press. Got a fan there. Mary Hedar, Washington Post Style Section Editor. Jerry Slater, Executive Vice President of WETA FM 91, which carries Prairie Home Companion in this area. Ula Skervid, wife of our speaker. I'll skip over our speaker for the moment. and go to Randy Allen, Vice President of Pyramid Video and Chairman of our club's Speakers Committee, Dave Gergen, Editor of U.S. News and World Report, Lynn Cheney, who was just sworn in today as the new chairperson for the National Endowment for the Humanities. And Jim Angle, National Public Radio White House correspondent. In the spring of 1974, according to our guest, he and his wife and four-year-old son were going by train from St. Paul to San Francisco. The train gently derailed in Idaho, and they were forced to take a bus on the next leg of their trip. When they got to Portland, Mr. Keeler took his son to the bathroom and accidentally left a briefcase there with two of his newly prized, newly written stories. The missing stories were never found, and ever since then, he says, he's been looking for them to turn up inside his head, where other stories somehow just aren't so fine. A lot of other people, however, disagree. They include the people who compare Garrison Keeler to Mark Twain,